The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. David, before we bring our guest on today, Professor Ocampo, I want to just talk to you about why we have the guests we have. When the euro was starting to come under pressure a couple of years ago, we had Otmar Issing on, the man who could be considered one of the fathers of the euro. We've got a situation right now where you and I have been actively talking about China. It's been a emerging market that's been dependent on the West. It's really needed our demand and our money to grow its own economy. And the question is, does it shift to supplying its own needs?
This is a part of a bigger picture, which is the developing world has it somehow disconnected from the developed world.
Right.
And some analysts think that that has, in fact, taken place. And we would strongly disagree with it, mainly looking at a theory of liquidity, which says money is flowing from the industrial and the developed world, and there's a positive impact as that liquidity flows downstream to anyone downstream. And so it really, when you look at the movements of progress in the developing world, it really is dependent on the health of the developed world countries and the industrial world. So when we take these broad issues and we say, okay, well, beyond our own reading, who would add value to a conversation like this? Who would bring a perspective? I think of Professor Jose Ocampo, because here's a guy who was nominated, one of three, nominated as the World Bank president, replacing Robert Zoellick this summer. And he dropped out of the race in April, but he still serves with the United Nations, teaches economics at Columbia University, and brings a very interesting perspective, because not only has he taken various posts with the United Nations as Undersecretary General for Economic and Social Affairs, Executive Secretary for the Economic Commission of Latin America and the Caribbean, but also playing a role in the Colombian government as Minister of Finance, Public Credit, and Minister of Agriculture and Rural Development. So you've got these things. There's a good reason why he was posted and potentially the World Bank president. It's a development institution.
And you mentioned, I mean, we've been talking about the World Bank report to China. China is using this possibly as a model of economic change. And we've talked to guests in the past, and you and I have talked about this, that political change has to occur as well. And I'm hoping that you're going to ask that question when you talk to Professor Ocampo.
Certainly. And this is, again, where we certainly go beyond just sort of the choir of people that we always talk to, always read, even always agree with, to say what really is the context that we're in. Is this an issue of decoupling? Could we be wrong? Could we, in fact, see the developing world exceed all expectations and lead a recovery economically over the next 5 to 10 years? And so, again, we want to embrace as many different opinions as we can as we look at these issues. And here's a gentleman who I think adds tremendous value to the conversation in that regard. Studied at Notre Dame in his undergrad, PhD in economics from Yale. And so, again, kind of a blend of academic pursuits there at Columbia, policy pursuits through the United Nations, and then, of course, his sort of boots-on-the-ground experience in policy implementation with the government in Colombia. And I would note, I think Colombia is one of the great success stories. If you look at the last 5-10 years, not only do we have sort of an underlying support for that in the free trade agreements which the U.S. has signed with both Colombia and Panama in recent years, but there's been policy changes, political reform, as well as economic reform, that over the last 5 to 7 to 10 years has put them as one of the leading growth economies in Latin America. And again, so we wrap all that up in one bundle, and we welcome Jose Ocampo, Professor Ocampo, to the conversation.
Well, we are in the midst of a global slowdown induced by the major industrial countries, particularly Western Europe, in which the developing countries are still growing more rapidly, but they are also slowing down.
The support for these trends, the major move forward, the rise of the rest, it's taken place in a certain context. We've had now for about 40 years exponential credit growth in the developed world. And also an unleashing of fiat money, followed by the end of the Bretton Woods Agreement, with many benefits in terms of capital flows going to the developing world, or at least this would be one interpretation of events in keeping with the Kindleberger or Minsky in terms of their ideas of liquidity. The question I would have as we look at this period of slowdown, global slowdown, can we avoid a devolution in this context of constrained capital flows, diminishing foreign direct investment, a contraction of credit, the things that have helped aid the developing world? How do we avoid this devolution?
From the perspective of developing countries, stable capital flows are good, particularly most forms of foreign direct investment, not all, as I will mention, but the volatile flows, which are the financial flows, have been a source of significant progress, generating booms and busts, very much like in credit growth, and then the busts have generated problems, a la Minsky, let's say, in industrial countries. So it would actually be better for the industrial assets, and certainly for the developing countries, to limit certain forms of capital mobility, much in the spirit of the original Bretton Woods arrangement of 1944.
What are the risks, in your opinion, to economic and political stability should we step back from free trade and what we have had as an advancement of globalization? If we should see that move in the opposite direction, what are the palpable risks, in your opinion?
Well, increased trade has broadly been good for the world. But at the same time, it has limited the possibility of some countries encouraging new production activities. And this is, of course, particularly important for developing countries which have lagged behind in the development process. So from that perspective, and I guess we can add to that, what people like Danny Roderick have been pointing out for a long time, which is that it also reduces the possibility or the room to maneuver to undertake, active social policies, for example, policies aiming at increasing wages. For that reason, probably a better balance between global trade and some form of national interventions aim at facilitating the diversification of economic activity, as well as the active social policies may be good for the global economy.
When we look at your opportunity to have served with the World Bank, perhaps you can reflect with us on the approaches to development issues that they've had in the past. Should they take a different tack, in your opinion? Under your leadership, would you have changed the approach?
Let me clarify that I work for the United Nations. I was a candidate for World Bank president, but they didn't elect me. They elected Mr. Kim, the current president, an American. So in my work for the United Nations, where I work for about around 10 years, I always push for the idea that I just mentioned. The fact that some form of capital account regulation may be good, but of course some freedom of foreign direct investment has been positive for developing countries in general. And that, again, growing world trade has been an opportunity for many developing countries, but developing countries should also have the opportunities to intervene to, improve the diversification of economic activity and to facilitate active social policies.
What I like about your bio is that it combines both academic experience as well as policy experience, both with the United Nations and with the government of Colombia. And there's roles that you've played there, Minister of Finance, Public Credit, Minister of Agriculture and Rural Development, which give you a very unique insight into what reforms are necessary for there to be economic and social development. And I'm curious, what role does political reform play in the development of a country from less to more or less fully developed, in your opinion?
You mean the political politics and social, political or economic policy?
Really strictly political reform. Let's take China as an example. We have the reforms that were set in place in 78 and 79, and these were more economic than political in nature. Even today, the changes that are suggested by the World Bank 2030 study are primarily economic reforms, and there's not a lot that is representative of change to the political environment. And that would be a question. How far can you go in terms of economic development without seeing complementary political reform?
Well, let me say that I am a Democrat, so democracy is a value by itself. It's part of the fundamental freedoms that people should have. So I am fully for democracy, period. There is a point in which, you know, some people argue that, you know, that autocracy may be better for economic development at certain stages. I disagree with that. I don't think there is firm evidence that that is correct. There is also, you know, the argument that sometimes democracy generates problems, for instance, uncertainties associated to political processes. Yes, that may be correct, but, you know, that's, I think the cost of eliminating democracy are much higher than those uncertainties.
And this is right to the core of the point, because it seems to be missing. I mean, one of the most important developing world countries today, China, second largest economy in the world. It's hardly even fair to call them a developing country anymore. But you have this idea that the global public sector development institution, the World Bank, discusses at length how they can move forward with economic reform. And yet, in nearly 300 pages, little to nothing is put in there. And again, this is a public sector development institution neglecting one of the things that is at core public sector. Where's the political reform? And this may be just for politically sensitive or diplomatic reasons, but corruption, depending on the estimates in China, varies from 4% of GDP upwards to 17% of GDP. And again, it makes it very difficult to engage economic reform when you have vested interests, again, tied into the body politic. So that just to say, yes, democracy is something that is prized. And really, what we would be interested in is what role do you think the rule of law plays in the future development of developing countries?
Well, again, the rule of law is an essential ingredient of a democratic regime. So it's a value in and for itself. And so I fully support the idea that, you know, democracy and the rule of law should be adopted by all developing countries. I think the rule of law actually is good for economic development in general. So the uncertainties that surround the absence of the rule of law are generally disadvantageous for developing countries.
Middle-income countries still have about 70% of the world's population living on less than $2 a day. And again, going back to that World Bank study, the World Bank's China report, China 2030, there's an interesting chart that pointed out that in 1960, there were 101 economies that the bank classified as middle-income. Now, by 2008, fast forward, half a century later, 13 had made it into the high income category, and Greece is included in that. You're a development expert. What, in your views, is the way for progress to be made? We've just gone through one of the greatest periods of globalization in world history. Why have so few developing countries gotten over the hurdle and actually entered into the high income category?
Yeah, that's a fundamental question in, of course, in development economics. I would say that it's the same thing that you have at the national level. I mean, in a sense, the mobility of people, you know, across income classes is not an easy job. I mean, very few people make it, let's say, from the middle class into the upper class. But the opportunities at the national level are always, the opportunities for mobility at the national level are always supported by state policy. I mean, one of the major problems in the international community, there is not such a support. I mean, there was the idea of development cooperation, which has been in the air, let's say, since the Second World War, but the capacity of the international system to support that mobility has been relatively limited. I mean, a few countries have made it through, but, you know, you can see the constraints that are faced by developing countries in terms of the accumulation of capital, both human and physical capital, the capacity in particular to upgrade technologically. And even in some cases, you see that the process is not full. I mean, you mentioned the case of Greece. That may be a reflection of the fact that the that Greece does not have the full ingredients of a developed country. And that's probably true of several other countries that sometimes make it to the top for other reasons. For example, I mean, many of the countries that make it to the top in terms of income is just because they discover oil. That doesn't make a country developed.
Couldn't agree more. A past guest on our program, Hernando de Soto, has suggested that property rights and clear title of land held by an individual allows for the leveraging of personal balance sheets and capital investment into businesses. Just one benefit of unlocking real estate values. The respect of property rights is rooted in the rule of law, what we discussed earlier. Doesn't a healthy respect for the rule of law precede that economic unleashing and arguably the step from developing to developed world status? How would you introduce that diplomatically into the developing world as a fundamental cornerstone, the respect for the rule of law?
Well, let me point it out that the property rights is only a limited part of the rule of law, and I will furthermore make the point that Mr. De Soto tends to overestimate the contribution that property rights can make to development. I mean, the fact that people have some, you know, limited property and can use it to improve their standard of living doesn't, you know, allow most poor people to get out of poverty. I think Mr. De Soto has always overestimated that. You know, now, saying that, the rule of law is a broader concept, because the rule of law refers to not only to, you know, to this particular issue of property rights, but refers to issues such as, for instance, the access of population to social services, the division of power in society, and how that is managed, so that there is countervailing powers placed that avoid the autocracy from prevailing. It also reflects in a democracy the right to elect people, to have the freedom of speech, the capacity to be represented directly by certain groups in power structure. I think all of those are good for development, which is the point that I made previously.
As the old Greek phrase goes, there's many a slip between the cup and the lip. If we look at developing world countries having made great progress in recent decades, there's a growth model that has been in place. Do you feel there's some dependence in the growth model of the last 30 to 40 years on Western Europe and the U.S. and a need for a new growth model?
Well, very well-known Latin American economist Mr. Previs always thought of the international economic system as a center-periphery system, a system in which some industrial countries, the U.S., Western Europe, Japan, let's say, have been at the center of the system, and developing countries are in the periphery. Now, that conception, I think, broadly speaking, is the correct one. Within that system, of course, the opportunities for developing countries to advance through the attraction of foreign direct investment are always, you know, positive ingredients that allow the developing countries to sometimes, but not very frequently, to reduce the the gap that in income between industrial and developing countries. Now, still, the world has lived until very recently under that system. So the major, let's say, dynamic forces always come from industrial countries, particularly in terms of technological development, of the generation of business cycles. Developing countries are takers of, you know, they are absorbers of that technology. They are business cycle takers rather than business cycle makers. Still, I think we have not seen a world in which developing countries are the source of those dynamics. I mean, they have grown faster for around 10 years, significantly faster, actually, for around 10 years. But we still have to see whether, for example, China or even less likely India become the true engines of the world economy. I mean, that role is still for the industrial countries, because we continue to live under a center-periphery system. I mean, the closest to that, to a change in the system, is the possibility that China will emerge as an alternative pole of the world economy. But still, it's a bit far from that position, particularly because it is not yet a major source of technology, the way the U.S. or Western Europe or Japan are sources of technological innovation.
when you look at the changes over the last 25 years, sort of the migration in emphasis from the G2 to the G3, 7, 8, now the G20, you know, with an institution like the World Bank, you have as much as 77 countries with opinions on what should and should not be done. And this has led some analysts to conclude that we've effectively moved to a G0 world, devoid of leadership and fractured by too many divergent interests and opinions. How do you see this greater, if you want to call it, democratization in global leadership? And how do you define leadership in this period?
Well, that's a fantastic question. And your observation that maybe we're under G0 is a wise one. We have seen in the last few years some cases of leadership, but they don't necessarily last for too long. I mean, for example, it is quite clear that after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the actions of the major industrial country central banks, industrial country governments, played a role in helping to avoid the catastrophe. And then the G20, particularly in its London meeting in April 2009, made a major advance, major push towards the recovery of the global economy. But then it didn't last. I mean, we have seen that a movement from that, G4 or 5, let's say, to a G20, you know, as you point out, maybe to a G0. And in other areas, we have seen inadequate action. Let's say the most important long-term issue that the world is facing, which is climate change, is an issue in which there has been no action yet. Even the signing of the Kyoto Protocol, which was the major advance in this area, ran into difficulties. Almost no country met the commitments in the Kyoto Protocol, and you know, the United States did not even join the protocol. In the negotiations that have been going on in recent years, there has been no real advance, and we are still waiting to see whether the international community would reach an agreement on this critical issue.
Drawing on your experience with ag policy and what you had done, Ministry of Agriculture there in Colombia, let's talk about the recent food price volatility. Primary staples have risen a minimum of 15.5%. In the case of soybeans, just in this last year, you have a 52% increase. What are the impacts you see in the developing world from these sharp shifts in price?
I think there are several issues that you have to separate. I mean, the strict volatility is a problem by itself. And the most important reason for that is that the poor of the world spend a large proportion of their income on food staples. You know, as much as 50 or more percentage of their incomes are going into food. So when there is a sharp increase in food prices, you know, many people in the world, you know, see their livelihoods threatened significantly by that event. So reducing the volatility of food prices would be good. The second is, what is the source of volatility? I think the basic reason is the lack of adequate stabilization mechanisms. In the past, we were much more successful in doing that than currently, because we have the much stronger state interventions trying to regulate agricultural markets. And there has been a claim by many that the intervention of finance in purchase of, let's say, of derivative contracts in commodity markets has been an additional source of volatility, which is probably correct. Now, beyond that, I think the long-term issues of agricultural prices have, I think, two dimensions. The first one is to recognize that, yes, there has been a significant medium-term increase in agricultural prices, but people forget that the 1980s and 1990s were terrible for agricultural producers. I mean, prices collapsed on average by around 40%. If you compare the levels of the late 1990s with the levels of the 1970s. So there has been a recovery of prices viewed from that perspective rather than a price boom by itself. And second, the long-term solution to these problems is more agricultural research, more technology, in other words. There had been in the past, you know, major advances in the agricultural technology and the green revolution in the developing world, being the you know 1960s, 1970s being the most important one, and there are many others that you know are still going on. For example, through the spread of biotechnology, but there are many, many progress still in the world. For example, the research on agricultural tropical agriculture has always been minimal relative to the research on you know on temperate zone agriculture, which is the agriculture of industrial countries. So the north, south, and, you know, the center periphery division plays again here because there has been a really inadequate research for the tropics in terms of agriculture.
So with the recovery, not necessarily a price boom, but with the recovery back to levels that we saw prior to the 80s and 90s, you know, one of the things that we've had is an adjustment, and it's been a cultural adjustment. We had the food riots of 07 and 08. We had the Arab Spring last year. We see a number of underdeveloped countries that are quickly and dramatically affected by food inflation. I'm reminded of the recent release of corn and rice from the Chinese reserves in order to contain food inflation. Let's look at that in the context of the developing world. You have, again, both an advantage here in your analysis of having experiences as an ag minister, but also your roles at the UN. I think you have the ability to see the political and the geopolitical knock-on effects of food inflation. Do we have more political volatility ahead of us because of this factor?
Oh, certainly. And let me say that I think this is a very important issue currently. I think the world has to come to realize that it has to adapt to the management of this problem in a serious way, which means I think more support to research in agriculture, more intervention in markets, for instance, more you know greater buffer stocks to try to smooth prices, and I think finally. When the conditions are difficult, there has to be income support for the poor, so that they are able to buy the agricultural goods or even subsidies for the consumption.
Professor Ocampos, thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully we can call upon you to add to our conversation again in the future.
Yes, that would be my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, David, I think it's an interesting concept to think of this center and periphery type of mindset, okay, because the center so far has been the industrial world. I mean, when you are producing something or when you have an active, and let's face it, it was the free market that created the industrial world. The developing world is the periphery. They have benefited. But, you know, using China as an example, China's going to have to figure out how to get to the center before they solve the problem.
Well, and this is exactly our point, is that you have a prevailing trend in place, and the trend has been set by the industrial world. We are the makers, the rest of the world are the takers, and to some degree, we like to see healthy competition come into that, where takers progress, and in fact, have the potential to someday exceed or excel beyond being just takers and moving to that status of makers. But this is the main point. You have financial flows which have enabled great growth in the developing world, and those same financial flows and foreign direct investment are more limited today than they have been over the last 10, 15, 20, and 30 years. And with those limited financial flows means there really is a change in the tone, tenor, and direction, the success variables, if you will, in the developing world. We think China has its own problems. And certainly, as you're looking through Latin America, if you're looking through Africa, if you're looking to India, they are in the same position of vulnerability. Vulnerability. And this goes back to our conversation with Harold James. Contraction and globalization and the potential for political volatility. This was underscored in our conversation today with Professor Ocampo as we looked at one more variable, not just globalization and a contraction in that trend, but political volatility on the other side of an increase in the value of food, something so basic and yet for many people, again, living on less than $2 a day, so very, very important.
Well, and I think it's ironic, David, and it was an interesting insight. This is a man who's very much into upper-level management. Okay? He works for the UN. That says enough. He feels like global climate change is one of the big issues. But really, whether you think global climate change is a big issue or not, I think the main point that you were making and he was making was maybe the G20, maybe the UN, maybe the World Bank, this upper-level management, doesn't really really have the power that they thought they had, because even with the climate change, there was really no teeth in it. And you had brought up, are we in a G0 world? He lit up when he heard that, because even though he's part of these organizations, he's seeing they don't seem to have teeth.
We need clear leadership. We need confident leadership. We need leadership that is reflective of a philosophy that works. And that is all of the above. We're missing. It's lacking. And I think everyone is aware of it. Everyone's longing for it. Everyone's hoping for it. But it is not there. It is not there. So yeah, the transition again towards democratization, it's almost as if we've expanded, and now, like the rubber band that's reached its outer limits, is contracting again, and we're moving back towards who's going to call the shots? Who's going to lead with clarity on the issues of our day, whether it is global poverty and development issues like they hit up with the World Bank, or just basic issues? How's our economy going to grow?
Right.
What's going to stimulate a business owner to take greater risk and improve his lot in life by growing his franchise? How do we get that done? We need someone or a group of people, and frankly, I don't know that they're here yet. I think as we look forward, and this is perhaps a philosophical reflection, going back to our interview when we talked about the fourth turning,
right.
We haven't gone far enough through this crisis to see or to recognize the leadership to remake the world of tomorrow.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Professor Jose Antonio Ocampo. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.